Hello, this is Leslie Garth of Tenzer, and this is Legal Tenzer, casual conversations on noteworthy legal topics. Electronic vehicles, or EVs, have been around for over a decade. Originally, EVs were thought to be a key in helping us achieve control of our climate. More recently, however, some environmentalists have raised concerns about their efficacy. My guest today, Professor Lisa Benjamin, is here at my special request to explain the difference between EVs and gas-powered cars as it relates to helping our environment. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So, you know, you came to Pace Law School and you spoke about this. And after it was all over, I asked you this question. I really thought EVs were the way to go. And what you highlighted to me was this concern about batteries and you know, battery removals and battery kind of disposal. So what's one to do?
Yeah, it is a complicated question with a conditioned answer. So if you're just thinking about environmental impacts in terms of climate change, which is the area that I work in primarily, which is why I was drawn to writing this article, EVs are hands down the better choice. So cradle to grave, battery electric vehicles are a much cleaner choice, particularly for emissions. Even if you are powering your electric vehicle through coal-based electricity from a grid, it's still cleaner. It's cleaner still if the grid that you're powering your vehicle from is based on clean electricity. And it's cleaner still if the manufacturer or the warehouse where the car is manufactured is also running on clean, renewable energy. So in all those three scenarios, EVs compared to your traditional gas-powered cars are much cleaner in terms of emissions, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, and they're also much better for the environment in terms of air pollution itself. So it's definitely a better choice, but it's not the perfect choice for either the environment or environmental justice communities. And I knew this going in, and so I was drawn to writing the article because I really wanted to look at what's the balance that we're looking at here? So there are clearly benefits, but there are also drawbacks to this technology. It's not the sort of perfect choice because we're also imposing burdens on some communities.
So, you know, my listeners know I'm not an environmental teacher. And it was interesting when you first talked about this, about the idea of clean, renewable energy versus coal-based energy. How does one get clean renewable energy versus coal-based energy? So for instance, I mean, I live in a suburban area right outside of New York City. If I have an EV, I'm going to power it through my home electricity, I presume, right? So how do I get clean renewable energy?
So it'll depend on your electricity provider. And it also depends on the state that you're in and how they're transitioning to cleaner electricity. The grid system in the US was traditionally primarily fossil fuel generated, so that you're looking primarily at coal-based generation. But that has shifted tremendously in the past 10 years or so. And actually, one of the primary motivators of that are states. So states themselves can impose renewable portfolio standards, so requirements on utilities to have a certain percentage of the electricity being provided by renewable energy. Some states have 100% clean electricity goals, and the Biden administration at the federal level has put a very aggressive target on electricity itself transitioning to clean electricity across the United States. So heating is a different system. That's a different question. Okay. But in terms of electricity itself, there are some really ambitious goals. New York has some really ambitious clean electricity goals, but it will depend on the state that you are in. So it varies state by state. Interestingly enough, the fuel that powers the majority of cars is oil. It's not coal. And so when you transition your electricity grid to clean electricity like wind or solar, and you get rid of an internal combustion engine, you're actually using clean electricity and getting rid of the oil that is polluting the air and contributing to climate change as well. So if we can do both at the same time, that's the magic bullet, right? In terms of reducing emissions for climate change. And so that's why they're better, but it depends on your grid electricity system. It depends on all those things. But I do want to say that most people think that it's the electricity grid that contributes the majority of greenhouse gas emissions domestically in the US. It's actually transportation. And so transportation a few years ago just became the major source, the majority of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. So transportation-based emissions are a huge contributor to climate change. And if we can transition away from oil, then it would make a 60, 70, 80% dent reduction in greenhouse gas emissions domestically in the United States. So the contributions of this transition are potentially huge for reducing the impacts of climate change.
So, what's the downside then of EVs?
So before I move on to the downside, I do want to talk about one more upside,
Okay.
which is air pollution. And so we think about transportation for greenhouse gas emissions, but cars, particularly diesel-based cars, are a major contributor to air pollution. And one of the reasons I was attracted to this because I teach environmental justice. And from that class, I talked to my students about highway-adjacent communities. And highway-adjacent communities are primarily communities of color. And they're communities of color because of the discriminatory and racist highway planning policies that took place federally in the United States. So from the 1950s through the 1970s, 80s, and even today, highways were purposely built next to or through communities of color, primarily Black communities. And that is infrastructure that's stuck. It's really hard to move a highway. In fact, most of the work on highways is expanding them to make it worse. So those communities are literally next door to a major source of air pollution, which is cars and traffic. And that leads to traffic-related air pollution, which also made these communities really vulnerable to the impacts of COVID-19 because traps, that pollution from traffic can cause heart disease, asthma, lung diseases,
Oh, interesting.
cardiovascular diseases. You end up with all of these pre-existing conditions that made you more vulnerable to COVID-19. And so transferring away from internal combustion engines to cleaner vehicles on highways can actually be hugely beneficial for these communities because it's hard to move a highway, but if you change the cars that are driving on the highway, then you reduce this kind of pollution. And this pollution is insidious. I mean, air pollution causes 100,000 premature deaths in the United States. Those are primarily in communities of color. And then they're intergenerational. So mothers in particular, when they're living next to highways, can give birth to stillborn babies, preterm babies. And so these are intergenerational harms that are being passed on. So it's really, this transition is really important for certain environmental justice communities and can be very beneficial. And I don't want to overlook that because it's actually a really important part of the solution for air pollution itself.
That's a really interesting observation. I don't, did you read the book Lessons in Chemistry? This
No.
is, oh, so one of the biggest plot, it's a book and it's also a movie. And it's really about feminism, but one of the biggest plots is that there is an African American woman who is leading the charge to not build a highway right through her community. This is in the 50s.
Oh, yes, I did see this. Yes,
And she
it's
loses.
great.
She doesn't even win. She loses. So, anyway, it explains your point. So,
No,
anyway.
I did watch that and it was great. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, these communities fought back, but these highways were built and you're stuck with the infrastructure. It's really hard to move a highway, so.
But that's such an interesting observation of you to make because I don't think people see beyond, oh, there's gas in the air, oh, there's black smoke coming out of the chimneys. So I don't think we see the kind of re way it reverberates through to, I never would have tied pollution to COVID-19. So I'm glad that you made that thought, but I am still going to hold you to explaining to me the downside of EVs.
Yeah, so instead of using oil, EVs use batteries. And the minerals that you have to mine for these batteries are what's called critical minerals. And there are things like lithium, which is the main mineral that we think about when we think about electric vehicle batteries. But these are also minerals that go into defense systems, our laptops, our cell phones, wind turbines, solar panels. And so there's going to be a much greater demand for these minerals anyway. But the push towards electric vehicles is really going to exponentially increase the demand for these minerals. And it's hard at the moment to recycle them. And so you're looking at new mines to extract new sources of these minerals. And a lot of the minerals are found overseas. And so the US domestically
That's
hasn't produced a lot of these minerals themselves because it's a really dirty process. So countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo and China and some countries in South America, those are the primary producers of these minerals, and they process them, and then the United States imports them. But because they're so important for defense and aeronautics and renewable energy, the United States has decided, both in a bipartisan, both parties have decided that they want to push for domestic mineral mining so that we're not so dependent on foreign sources who can sort of choose whether or not to export to the United States or not. And so that push for domestic mineral mining, in a sense, is beneficial because the US does have environmental protections that you may not find or may be difficult to enforce in, let's say, the Democratic Republic of Congo or China. But the downside is that a lot of these mineral resources just happen to be located either near or very close to Native American communities. And so that means that you're asking to place the burden of new mining on communities that have already been historically exploited for land and mining already by the federal government. And so it's the Bureau of Land Management and the US Forest Service that might be the primary agencies that would be responsible for issuing a permit for mining. And mining of these minerals is dirty. I mean, it really pollutes water, there's soil contamination, and there's so many abandoned mines in the United States, particularly near these communities anyway, that have never been cleaned up, that you're sort of adding new pollution onto existing pollution. And that is going to impose burdens on these communities because some of these minerals are located in environmentally sensitive sites or sites that have significant cultural importance to tribes. And so the problem here is that it's federal agencies that are going to be responsible for approving these permits. And because there's this huge commercial demand because of EVs and other technology and bipartisan government support, this mining is going to happen, and there's not sufficient protections in place, in my view, for these communities to sort of impose this additional burden on them.
And will are there health risks associated with it in addition? I presume going down any mine is not good for one, but what about just living in the area in which the mining is occurring?
Yeah, these mines are really dangerous. Some people fall in them, as particularly abandoned mines. And then the contamination of water means that your water sources could be permanently contaminated, the soil contaminated. I mean, they're really the tailings and the pollution from these minerals, the byproduct of mining, is really toxic. And in addition, it's a very water-intensive process of extracting these minerals. And then they're often found in very scarce areas where there's not a lot of water. And due to climate change, it's going to get drier and drier in these areas. So you're kind of taking scarce resources to extract another resource. And if you have a community that's relying on farming, or even fishing, if it's near a water source, then you're destroying those areas of livelihood for that community.
So I am going to break a rule of lawyering 101, which is never ask a question that you don't know the answer to, but I don't know the answer to this. But can the federal government, through eminent domain, take over land that's owned by, like, I don't know tribal law at all, but, if a Native American community owns land, can the federal government go in and just take it over and say, we're going to mine here?
It depends on the treaty rights that the tribe has with the federal government because treaties vary significantly. Some just give rights of access for cultural resources and exercising cultural practices and fishing and subsistence. And some are much more based on land tenure and responsibility. But the problem that I have is that the history of these agencies, like the Bureau of Land Management and the US Forest Service, they have a really questionable history when dealing with tribes, as has the federal government writ large. And in particular, mining has been such a historically profitable business that the federal government has literally amended treaties, so overridden existing treaty rights to allow people who are technically trespassing on Indian land to be able to mine there. And so there's a huge amount of distrust and a history of what I use the term established by others of settler colonialism. That's where land, people are just forcibly removed from the land by the federal government. And that land that used to be occupied or owned is now owned by the federal government. And so the Bureau of Land Management land, U.S. Forest Service land. There might be some rights to access culturally significant sites there, but they might not actually be owned by the tribes themselves, but they're important to them. And so in
Right.
those cases, then the federal government can just issue permits for mining, and those access rights will be jeopardized.
So it's not even like there's any kind of profitability for the Native Americans that live on, live near
No.
there.
I mean, if, my approach to environmental justice communities is self-determination. And so if a tribe wants to establish a mine on in their own land that they have the treaty rights to do, then go ahead. I mean, if it's economically
Right.
beneficial for you, then I have no problem with that. It's where the communities might not want the mine. At the moment, their consultation rights are pretty weak. And the way that the government has interpreted what's called the General Mining Act, which is 1872, I think, really old and has not been updated, it's clearly very pro-mining. And
Yeah.
so,
Oh, yeah. That
that
makes sense.
legislation has to be updated, or at least
Yeah.
under FLTMA, Federal Land Management Policy Act, the government should issue new rules to be more cognizant of, irreparable harm that could happen to this land, in particular to communities' rights and access to the land. And so I argue that there should be sort of more legislative change, and there is a bipartisan committee looking into updating the Mining Act. And some of the recommendations that they have are actually pretty good. And so some of the recommendations are, if it's culturally sensitive land, let's not access those first. Let's exploit and use federal land that, there are no claims to by Native American tribes. And so those are actually really helpful and important recommendations. Some of the other recommendations that I put forward in the paper was not just consultation, but co-management of these sites with Native American communities. And there are examples of this in Bears Ears Monument, for example, where you could have a council or a commission that has elected tribal members on it. So they actually have a say in how this will operate. And then I argue for your point, economic justice. It's really not fair to impose this burden on these communities if they're not going to benefit financially from this. And so some kind of economic justice tools, there's a Justice 40 initiative at the federal level where 40% of these projects should be invested back into communities. And I argue this is an example of where this should happen. These communities should be compensated because some of the harm, you just can't get rid of the toxins in the land once they've been polluted.
Yeah. So, bottom line, do I need to feel badly about not driving an EV or a hybrid?
I think that you do what you can afford to do in terms of climate change. And so EVs are expensive, which is one of the points I make. One of the other recommendations I have is to make them more affordable, particularly for environmental justice communities through grants or other incentives. The reason I wrote the article is because I happen to be renting in a very affluent, very white suburb of Portland. And every day I walk the dog, and every day there was a new EV. And I thought, this is a really important transition, but it can't just be exclusively for the wealthy. And
Right.
so I think there should be more financial help for people. At the moment, there are tax credits you can get, but you have to pay out. And I think they've just changed it so the dealership itself can reduce the tax credit. So I think it's $7,500 for electric vehicles that either are made in America or in a country with a free trade arrangement with the United States. So I think they should be made more affordable on the one hand, but until they are, and there's a limited used car market for EVs because they're so new. So until they are, I mean, people will have to make the decision that's best for their family. And there's a lot of other things you can do for climate change, like diet and all of that stuff. But also, EVs aren't the answer. So we need better public transportation as well. Some people will always have to rely on public transportation, and we should make that cleaner and affordable. The vast majority of federal dollars for transportation are pumped into highways, not into public transportation. So that also has to be part of the solution.
No, that mass transportation is really important. And I live in a community. Well, now they're actually about to impose, or who knows, there'll probably be lawsuits, but I don't know, New York's working on imposing congestion pricing. So it's
Yeah, they.
$65 if you go down past, I think it's 60th Street, and that really is going to change everything.
Yeah, so my friend that I was staying with in New York when I was visiting Pace in October, she was telling me about the congestion charge. And I was like, yeah, I lived in London. They did that like 20 years ago.
I know.
It shouldn't be a surprise to you, but you know.
I know. I know. I know. We were waiting. It's supposed to happen in, the spring, but we'll see. There's going to be a million lawsuits, so they already have. So we'll see what happens so far. Anyway, well, thank you so much for taking the time. I have learned a lot from you about this. And to your point, I don't buy red meat in the grocery store anymore.
Good
So
for
that's my
you.
contribution for the record.
That's excellent.
Anyway, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, or a professor or attorney with whom you'd like me to speak, send us an email at legaltenzer@westacademic.com and send us any suggestions you may have. We love getting feedback. Have a great day. This podcast was created in collaboration with West Academic. Additional episodes can be found on West Academic Study Aids collection. Students may already have access through their school subscription and can check with their law school library for access. For a limited time, Legal Tenzer listeners can save 15% on titles on the West Academic store with the promo code TENZER15 at checkout.